This episode is sponsored by Kokako Organic Coffee Roasters. Unhappy with the unavoidable carbon in their supply chain, Kokako decided in 2016 to become one of the first carbon-neutral coffee roasters in Aotearoa by offsetting their emissions with the Fair Climate Fund. Find a climate-neutral bag of beans for home at kokako.co.nz.
To How to Save the World. I'm Waveney and I'm with Tim.
Hello.
Hey, I think this is a special episode, Tim, because it's all about you.
They're all special episodes, aren't they?
Yes,
they're like kids. There's no favourite.
No.
Special in their own way.
Yeah. Yeah, so we are going to be talking about how you are vegetarian and even vegan.
Yes.
These days, and how I'm not.
We're going to battle.
That's right.
We're going to duke it out.
Yeah. I used to be... At high school, I won the debating competition.
Oh.
Yeah.
Formidable.
I was quite formidable.
And I'm in my weakened state with no meat in my blood.
Oh,
so
yeah. True. Your whole,
your
brain's just constantly in a meatless, foggy fatigue.
You actually, when you came in, you said, you didn't phrase it exactly like this, but you said, we're going to have a debate. I'm going to push back against you. And I have a suspicion that I think we're going to agree on probably the crux of what you're saying, but the first thing is, yeah, I'm vegan. I'm eating vegan.
It sounds like a question.
It is because
high rising terminal.
Well, yeah, it is because, like, I don't know. I always hear people call themselves a vegan. It's not an identity that I want to. It seems like a weird identity.
Yeah.
It's a diet. It's just stuff.
Yeah,
I
yeah,
eat,
yeah.
You know
yeah,
what I
yeah,
mean?
Yeah.
I haven't been doing it for that long either, so it's just like, I'm eating a vegan diet.
Okay,
I guess is what
so you're eating a vegan diet, but you're not actually officially in the vegan club.
Well, I guess by definition, I am. It's just like my entire life, you know, you get this idea about what vegans
are. Oh, that's true. The stereotypes.
Absolutely, the stereotypes, and it's just like this very loaded term, which means a whole lot more than just the diet. But it's like, you know, a whole philosophy and. The stereotype is shoving it down other people's throats.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
And I guess doing a podcast episode on it isn't probably helping break that stereotype. But so what I've done is I've done a little bit of research on kind of the two reasons why I decided to go vegan. I can sort of talk to where I got there. But did you want to throw any questions at me or anything like that, or?
Yeah, I'll see how I go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I just pick off the
I'm going to save that arsenal, yes.
Sure. Well, I guess the first bit is how I came to be vegan at all. So this, I think I might have already told this story on the podcast about how I went pescatarian when Trump got elected.
Yeah, I love that.
Because I just felt like I had to do something. On that day when it happened.
One of my big missions has been trying to depoliticize, like decouple sustainability and how you vote. But
really?
Yeah, but you're linking it right back up.
Well, hey, that's just me. That's just me personally. And I don't know, I think it's a tricky one. I've heard this term bandied around or this philosophy bandied around in a slightly different context. But, you know, it's hard to treat anything not politically, apolitically. Mm, everything is political, kind of.
And I totally love that story anyway. It's great.
It was just my inspiration for taking the plunge finally, because I had been living with a lot of vegetarians, like in my old flat. I know a lot of like creatives and people who work in theatre and the arts and film and television, that sort of stuff, which seems to attract those kind of people. Mm. And my ex-girlfriend was vegetarian after reading that book. Do you know what it's called? It's some really popular book. It's like the Alan Carr book for quitting smoking, but for eating animals.
No,
if
I had have read it, perhaps I'd
maybe
be a vegetarian.
Be in the club.
Yeah,
I haven't read that book, but four of my flatmates did, and they all went vegetarian.
Whoa.
It's all about this guy who is going to have a kid. I think the kid's on the way, or the kid's very young, and he wants to look into farming practices because he's kind of like, well, this is what my kid's going to eat. This is how I'm bringing them up. So I should probably know some background about how this gets, you know, on the plate.
What country were they in?
Oh, I couldn't tell. I should really look this up. America, I'm going to assume.
Yeah.
And the first thing he came up against was such a barrier to figuring out, like no one would answer any questions about what was going on.
It's a sure sign.
Yeah, which is not good. I'm going to see if I can look it up. Eating Animals, I think, is the name of the book. Yeah, by Jonathan Safran Foer, I believe his name is. And it's super popular. It's got like 55,500 ratings on Amazon, on Goodreads. Anyway, so I was surrounded by vegetarians for a long time. I was thinking about it for a while, never did anything. Used to eat a whole lot of meat. Went pescatarian finally in 2016 at the end. And then did that for like 2 years. And then the thing that made me finally take the plunge, because I've been thinking and talking about the veganism thing for a long time, was I read two books back to back by a guy named Yuval Noah Harari, who's this Israeli dude who wrote Sapiens and Homo Deus. And I'm reading the third one at the moment, which is called, I think, 21 Solutions for the 21st Century. Mm-hmm. And they were such good books. They were amazing. And they're about a whole bunch of stuff. They're about like big ideas, big concepts. Talks a lot about AI and that sort of stuff and what it means to be human. The first book is like almost a history of Homo sapiens.
Sapiens. I've read that. Amazing. I think I read it after a conversation you and I had.
Oh, true.
Yeah, I think so. And one of the things I'm pretty sure is in that book is how that ability for us to start eating cooked food, particularly cooked meat, was actually a bit of a cognitive leap for us, because we could then use more energy to think rather than process and digest the food.
Absolutely. I had forgotten all about that. You're right. That was what he calls the cognitive revolution, which was a huge part of it. Our species that we were
quite weird that that comes down to cooked meat.
Well, I guess it's just we found a source of energy that was so dense that we didn't have to constantly forage and we could use our time and energy on other things.
So it's pretty integral.
It's Well, it was to that particular stage of our development.
Okay.
We're not there anymore.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I would think it's analogous to how you, when you're a developing country, you go through different cycles of electricity generation, you know? You go through the coal phase and then you can get into renewables later on.
So okay.
Just because you started with something doesn't mean you have to stay with it the whole time. So I read that book, and the thing that really stuck with me in Sapiens, I think it was in Sapiens, was he talks about cows and just them as an animal and as a species, and that they're actually like incredibly emotional creatures. Mm. And despite the fact that we've been breeding them specifically just for meat and animal products, they're still really intelligent, because you would think, you know, after all the generations of agriculture that we've had, we would have kind of bred them to be as dumb as possible so they don't fight back against us and they can just be this big steak that's sitting around waiting to be harvested. But despite that selective breeding they've been through, they still, even now,
they've got their family structures.
They do. And, they've got really complex social structures. They have like best friends. They've got really strong family bonds as well.
Oh, best and friends.
They do. Cows have best friends.
I know that when they go to be milked, they're in, and they're, even if it's a huge herd, they're in a really specific order.
Yeah.
Like every day they go off, I guess, with their friends and So is the crux, because this is interesting, is the crux of your argument going to essentially be around the humanity of it, not the ethics?
It's twofold. The original thing that got me into it was water usage, which we'll talk more about in a moment. But the once I had like started sort of, you know, I was in it a bit more, and you just by osmosis, I think, kind of absorb different ethical reasons why you would be vegan. You hear other people's points of view, just little things online pop out at you. It very much increasingly became about animal rights and just what we are doing.
I think so, anything around that, I don't feel like there is much of an answer for in terms of anything I've got to give back, because it's like a hard thing to argue. I totally agree.
The ethics of it are not not great.
But if you're gonna kill a cow, then to eat, then there's you've got to sort of say, well, what's the difference between that and a dog?
Yeah,
or, that's very hard to ethically argue killing, that. I think
the killing isn't what I've personally got an issue with myself. It's certainly like an ethical quandary to bring a whole bunch of animals into existence just to kill them, but it's more their sustained existence.
The treatment, yeah.
So, like, how we get dairy is by getting a cow pregnant and then taking away its young, and then we harvest the milk, and they're in this sort of perpetual state of expressing a thing that's supposed to be for the young. And there isn't, as far as I can tell, I'm a total noob on this. I am by no means an expert, so just I want to put that up front. But there doesn't seem to be a tremendous amount of research that's happened into looking at animals like bovine and pigs that we have had for all of, you know, agriculture by humans to basically just serve as a food product, into them
their needs.
Socially
their
psychological makeup or abilities. But the small amounts of research that have been conducted have shown that they are, I think, way smarter than we thought and a lot more emotional than we understood them to be. And probably the biggest clue are these strong social bonds that they have. And I think that Harari talks about this in the book as well, is the incredible amount of stress that the cows go through when their young are taken away. And I mean, you can imagine any intelligent or semi-intelligent species, particularly mammals, if you take away their young, that's going to really freak them out. And cows are no different. And they've been able to measure that with things like the cortisol amounts they produce when they're under certain conditions and when they get their young taken away. So this is like all a very kind of new world for me, but it's sort of one of those things where once you pull back the curtain a little bit and look at it, it's a bit of a horror show. And pigs are insanely intelligent. They reckon, I've heard somewhere, I don't have the source in front of me, that pigs are smarter, that some pigs are smarter than like dogs, than a lot of dog breeds we have.
I heard that pigs are about as smart as a 3-year-old.
Yeah.
And I said that to a woman once with a 3-year-old.
How'd she respond?
Oh, she didn't take it well.
but this is another thing that Harari talks about in his books. He's like, humans have put themselves on this pedestal of being completely separate and apart and above all other animal species.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, we're apex predators. We're top of the food chain and we've gained all these abilities that other animals don't have. But from an ethical and moral point of view, does that mean we get to just like dominate like a pack of assholes?
I mean, if you looked at it within a family structure and say, well, the parents are there to care for the children, that's their role, it's like exactly the same thing. It's like, does that give you permission to be a dickhead and use the kids for whatever you want to do? It's like, it's, to think of it around the other way, is we are the custodians of this and to be there to care for these things.
Yeah, and there's a lot of religions that talk about that, because religion is sort of the, you know, oldest way that we had of structuring ourselves in society. So what is, you know, sort of interpreted through a mystical lens is often just good things, good rules on how to live.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
where it all came from.
The enthusiasm.
Yeah. And Larry David.
Yeah.
And so like with Hinduism and Christianity, we are totally seen as custodians of these animals, and we're there to look after them. And it's
and with a lot of indigenous, probably all indigenous cultures too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the respectfulness around to even taking leaves sometimes. And it's just you've got a process and you're giving thanks and you're being aware.
Because because in those constructs, particularly like first peoples, it's we're a part of the system. It's not like we're sitting above the system and using it for ourselves. It's a very new thing. This way that we're doing things now, with mass agriculture and having these insane farming practices, we have not had the ability to do this before, because we didn't have things like antibiotics, so we couldn't put a million chickens in a tiny little warehouse. Yeah.
I wonder, Tim, if we're on the same page, because for me, it's really the industrialized farming practices that we have, and to say that there's something really intrinsically wrong with eating meat or dairy or whatever is like throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because if we eat these things respectfully, then I guess it's like if we have that opportunity to give thanks, make everything the best choices we can in terms of what we're eating, it's like then is it okay?
Totally. I've got no... The only reason why I'm vegan is because I'm kind of like lazy.
Can't see the options. Ah, yeah.
Well,
I just...
I know that I need to put sort of blinders on myself, whereas if something's like wishy-washy, then I just won't do it.
No, that's good. So you're not like going to get a little bow and arrow and go out and, you know, start killing your own wild game.
That's definitely a movement at the moment of people who will eat meat, but they, you know, will eat the meat that they kill. Hunters who go out and, you know, they kill a deer and then you've got venison for ages. Mm.
You know what? Just yesterday I was thinking, well, this is timely, coming off to talk about this, is I filled the deep freeze up with home kill. Like, I have literally stacked a year's worth of meat.
Cow?
Yes. Yeah. But it was from a friend of mine who runs a really small little block up north near where we are, and she has only 3 cows, and they've had an amazing life. They're all organic. They've all, you know, just like everything that she loves her cows so much that this is quite common, I think. I've heard of other people that feel the same way, that when it comes to slaughtering, they are so upset that they either can't be there or they do it themselves and then they go off the meat and they can't eat it.
How do they do it? Do they shoot them?
I don't know. I think because I know for her, she didn't do it herself. She actually couldn't handle being there. Right. It's like a professional home kill person that comes and does the deed, but actually comes to the farm.
Yeah. Well, I imagine you get really attached to your cows if you were in that sort of small, doing it on that small scale. Mm. The other thing that feeds into this is, like, this is obviously a very aspirational thing, but I think it's quite important to try and live in a way where if, like, pretty much everyone lived pretty much how you did, things would be better.
Oh, yes, I like that one.
There's probably a better wording for that. I'm sure it's a whole philosophical
approach. This is not quite ready for the t-shirt, is it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think the small farming practices are so good. It's such a cool idea, but it is a little bit of a hard thing to be repeatable on a massive scale.
Oh, well, I don't know if I agree with that.
Well, come back and hit me with that, because it seems like it's very intensive for like things like land usage. And is it not?
So I think that there's sort of two schools of thought. You've got a lot of farmers in New Zealand, so globally, farming in a particular way, where essentially they're trying to, it's about intensity and trying to get as much as you can off the land in terms of how many animals you can pack in, how much turnover you can have. And there's a whole bunch of things that can be problematic in the long term, like can be really great short-term management and might be great in terms of the actual piece of land that you're managing, but you've got issues with what's happening with the system flows out, like whether it's nitrogen leaching into waterways or lack of carbon sequester. It could be really a lot of
methane and other gases.
A lot of methane and stuff. So you've got a school of thought that's saying, let's see if we can look after the environment as well as continue with this intensity.
Yeah.
And they're mostly, I think from what I can pick up, really looking for some bells and whistles with some new scientific technology.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so in that space, we're saying, oh, there's a gap. There's, you know, we're not there yet.
New Zealand's pretty good
for that,
right? We want
to crack this.
Like, we're pretty good at researching and developing new techniques.
Yeah, we're good with that. Yeah. But the thing that is also sitting right there alongside that is regenerative agriculture, which is people that are farming from a totally different origin, really. It's like it's been in parallel, but these two groups have been, because you've got your regenerative guys that are sitting there. I always can't say that word very well. Regenerative. The more I'm saying it, the worse it gets. But they're actually saying, well, actually, we do have farming practices where we can tick all of the boxes for the animals, their welfare, and for the environment as well, whether it's water quality or... So it turns out that soil is one of our most crucial ways of sequestering carbon. because the ocean is getting so full now that it's almost can't sink anymore. And you've got trees, obviously a really great carbon sink, but there's this fungi in soil that if the soil's managed well, it's actually probably one of our most significant, like globally most significant ways to sequester carbon.
Wow.
Yeah, and so there are certain farming practices where essentially you are just loading the soil up with biological life. So using a synthetic fertilizer and the pesticides that might often be associated with a monocrop, and of course grass is a monocrop, that can be quite counterproductive
for some of the fungi, presumably,
yeah,
for right?
the, it does, yeah, especially like anti-fungicides and things. But so there are ways to farm that actually tick all of the boxes. It's and they're a way for us as consumers to access those products. The scale isn't there, but I don't think that's anything that's due to the way that they're farming. I think that's more just to do with consumers not having quite responded to meet the demand of those products.
Well, but what you actually mean when you say that consumers not responding is it's fucking expensive.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, and people don't want to pay that. So,
oh, okay. Actually, I can't even remember this myself. My parents, when they were growing up, to have chicken, I don't know if this is globally true, certainly true in New Zealand, was a huge treat. It was like Christmas Day, you'd have a chicken. And now, of course, it's considered really cheap.
Yeah.
That overnight was because of when our laws changed and we allowed the factory hemp farming.
Right.
And so it's like we just have these expectations that a chicken should be something that we can eat once or twice a week if we want.
Yeah.
Whereas I can't afford that much chicken because I will be buying organic or locally grown through a farmer's market. Sure, you know, like all. So it's part of it's your headspace. It's like, yes, it's more expensive, but I mean, I guess if we can really connect with what the impact is of us having this cheap meat, and just start, like you were saying, you know, you read books, you went through this whole process.
Well, that book isn't even about this. It's about other stuff. It was just like there's a section in the book about that, and actually Harari turned vegan as a result of sort of him researching agricultural practices himself. He was like, this is mental. I cannot abide this. It's just one small component of the book, but just from kind of like a logical, ethical point of view, it really resonated
with me. Exactly, it's
like
catching your brain up with some of these things that we're just automatically doing. And I think it's a heart thing. Like, actually, I meant to say that conversation you and I had a few weeks ago about being vegetarian was probably the most significant conversation I'd had because you connected me with the heart stuff around it, which is like, wow, that's interesting. After years of these similar conversations, I was like, you know, something just sort of dropped in. Well, I'm going, yeah, it's true.
But
I guess if we can,
it's cumulative as
it
well,
is,
isn't it?
It is.
It was floating around in my head, both the going vegetarian thing, because I was thinking about that while eating so much meat for ages, and then I went pescatarian for a couple of years, and I had thought about going vegan for ages. Yeah, and it's at some point, it's just sort of like there'll
it
be
is,
one
it's
little
so,
thing.
It's so cumulative,
over.
Isn't it? But yeah.
The other thing which you're sort of talking about a little bit is the environmental impact, and specifically the thing that the main reason I went vegan first off is water usage. And like I, again, I'm no expert in this sort of stuff, but I printed off some things, so you might hear me flicking papers around and reading. But basically there's a lot of places are running out of drinkable water, and the planet's not running out of water, but we are running out of drinkable water in a lot of very populated places. About a year ago, there was a lot of news that you might have seen about Cape Town in South Africa literally about to run out of water, and they had to take extreme measures to stave off that kind of water apocalypse from happening. And I haven't caught up with it recently, but I know they've managed to sort of get their water usage down to a point where they are okay through at least the middle of this year, but I don't know if they've figured out a long-term solution to it. And they're talking about doing things like importing icebergs and melting them down there and stuff, really wacky, strange things that really don't, you know, instinctively make any sense because that is how horrific the situation is there.
They must have some really creative consultants. Can you imagine them brainstorming that?
Well, here's the thing. It's really hard to get fresh water if it's not just there. There is a process, and I'm probably going to disrupt the pronunciation, but desalinization.
Desalinization.
Which is basically just getting water from usually the ocean and removing all the minerals, usually salt, so that you can make it drinkable. And it is it's a scientific process that's possible, and we do it now on a small scale.
And does it use heaps of fossil fuel?
Well, if the electricity... it uses a lot of energy, I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
It uses a tremendous amount of energy. And there's a physical limitation to the technology. So, like I was reading about this today, that you actually can't get the process any more efficient than a certain amount, and it still will use, I think it's I'll try and find the sheet, but it's like 1 kilowatt per... 100 litres or something.
I'll try and look
up the thing.
But, I'm so untechie that anything like that just...
I love technology in that. So the way that they do it is basically filtration. There's a process called seawater reverse osmosis where they get seawater and they just force it through different stages of membranes, which are just filters. So it'll go through an initial filter where it takes out really big stuff, like actual visible sort of objects and stuff that's in
the
water.
You love this stuff, eh?
Yeah.
This is a lot of detail. You're like, this is how we desalinate water.
But the thing is like, it's actually a really simple concept, if I've understood it correctly. It's just forcing water through different filters.
It's like literally you could think about it, of
water going through like a sheet of paper.
Yeah.
You take out the big stuff and then you increasingly reduce the size of the pores in the filter or the membrane. So it gets down to the point where they're using really like advanced scientific materials that have things in the nanometers of sized holes so that can take out things like salt, which is obviously microscopic, but leave the water to pass through.
They could have just distilled it.
Distilled it like evaporation.
Yeah, like boil it.
But again, it takes a tremendous amount of energy to do that.
Like, I suppose they've thought of it.
Well, yeah, we'd be doing it. We would be doing it. And there's some interesting research that's going on in material science. Graphene nanopores. So graphene is this... I would almost class it as like a theoretic technology because it's sort of been talked about for the last 20 years as being this cure-all for so many different things. They talk about graphene a lot with computing. Just take a quick division. So it's this material that apparently, if we figure out how to use it properly...
Is this going to link back to...
It's going to solve everything.
Farming?
Yeah, well, it's about the water usage thing.
Yes.
So apparently if we figure out how to use graphene correctly, it would like open the floodgates, pun intended, for being able to filter seawater into making it drinkable. There's another method, titanium dioxide as well. But all of these are like being researched at the moment. No one has any idea how to scale them up. And using the ways that we do know how to do it, like evaporation is incredibly energy intensive. And even using the filter process, the reason why that is so energy intensive is you need to use a ton of pressure to force the water to go through that porous membrane so that it can let the water go through but keep the bad stuff out. So it's obviously been investigated. But it would be like the first thing that scientists and stuff look for an answer, and it's basically not a solution. So I've just found the bit about the, if anyone cares, if there are any scientists listening, 1 kilowatt hour to desalinate 1 cubic meter of seawater.
Thank you for that.
I don't have a frame of reference for those scales, but
factor.
It costs $4. For a unit, who even cares what the unit is, costs $4 to get it from river water from an aqueduct, and it costs $1,100 to get it desalinated from
the biggest scale we've ever used,
which was in Santa Barbara, used in the 80s. So that's a factor of, what's 1,100 divided by 4? About 300.
Yeah, it's huge.
A factor of 1 to 300 of getting it to a water.
I think that was the factor we were looking for, actually. That's a good one.
Long path, sorry. Yep. The fact is, it takes about 300 times the amount of money to draw drinkable water from desalinization from seawater.
Okay, so let's bring this back to you being a vegan.
Yeah, so it takes a lot of water to make animal products and not plants. That's it. Don't need to take you on a big path for that one.
Yeah.
Does your business need help navigating sustainability, the circular economy, and systems thinking? Contact GoWell Consulting, and one of their experts will guide your organization to a sustainable future. Their consultants provide a bespoke service by working intimately with your business. They make sustainability, the circular economy, and systems thinking accessible and easy to implement, allowing you to make well-informed decisions and capitalize on business opportunities. Future-proof your business and future-proof our planet. Go to gowellconsulting.co.nz to find an expert that will help your business navigate the journey.
That's I've right. got these tables that probably listeners of this show may have seen before about the different amounts of water that it takes to get different foods, which I think we've even maybe talked about in a
previous episode. I've seen those before. I don't know if we've talked about it here before, but basically it takes a heck of a lot of water to get, and because they do it per nutrient, don't they? Because you can say by weight or whatever that meat is so much more dense, but then they do it by weight and you realize, by nutrients, and you realize that it's still.
I haven't seen those ones, the nutrient ones. I've got one in front of me, which is just a kg of stuff and how much water it takes.
Yep.
And this is from the Institution of Mechanical Engineers, if anyone cares. This is the one that usually gets put in articles. From a big study they did in 2012. And so, for example, to get an egg, it is, they reckon, 196 litres of water. To get a kg of beef, it's 15,400.
Wow.
15.
Amazing.
Chocolate's even more, though. That's the terrible
more
thing.
More than
top,
beef?
Yeah, the top of the list is chocolate, and then it goes beef. So chocolate is above 17,000 litres to get 1 kg of chocolate, and beef is over 15,000. Sheep, over 10,000 litres to get a kg. Pork is about 6,000 to get 1 kg. And then you look at things like apples, a kg of apples, 800 litres of water.
Mm.
And cabbage, which would be, you know, sort of a staple-ish, or that kind of stuff for people like me, for dirty vegans. 135.
Just imagining big plates of cabbage, boiled cabbage.
Sorry, 235. So yeah, 235 for a kg of cabbage versus, you know, 15,500 litres for a kg of beef.
Mm.
And it makes sense, right? Because you are getting the crops and feeding it to something else, whereas vegans are basically just eating the animal
crop,
food,
taking
out that whole next layer to it. And I don't want to like preach too hard or anything, because I'm very new to veganism, and I'm not here to like necessarily convince other people to do it, but I'm just saying, for me, this is the reason why I did it, because we've kind of screwed up the planet hugely, and we're running out of drinking water for different reasons, but agriculture is a big part of that. And a solution to it is trying to eat less meat and animal products. And there's, I know I can feel the people typing already online. There's a lot of people who go, things like avocado, which is very popular among vegans, uses a huge amount of water, and almonds as well, which is another big good.
I had quinoa the other day.
Yeah.
As well.
So, and even rice isn't fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
Rice is on this list, and it is 2,500 litres for a kg.
So I think if we, you know how I'm always wanting to bring it back to, because at the moment we're unravelling into some sort of crazy reality where just everything's a problem. If we bring it back to what can we do, how do we really make this really simple? And I think you just said before, it's about eating less.
Yeah.
Meat. Full stop. Not yeah.
Oh, eating you mean
meat.
It all?
No, sorry, I didn't mean meat.
Put down the fork, fatty. Save the planet.
Yeah, maybe that's true. But anyway, I think, yeah, it's about eating less of that meat or these products that are an issue. I think that is just something that we can do. That's not a nice, quick, easy one. It actually doesn't take too much.
Yeah.
It's asking ourselves, do you know that when I first left home and went flatting, it was me and my mate that were sort of running this flat, and we had a budget of like $20, I think it was, for the week for food each. And we put that, we put that into a pot of money. And so I think we had about $100 and we'd go to Pack and Save, and we'd buy meat. We have like, you know, 7 lots of meat for us to get through the week. And I had this one, but we were all like 19, 20, and I'd just grown up meeting 3 veg.
Yeah.
And I had this one flatmate who, after sort of a few months, very tentatively approached me and my other flatmate that were sort of like, you know, the ones, the boss, I guess, and said, oh, do you think we have to have meat every night? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, do you think that maybe we could just, some nights where we have other things, like maybe we don't have to have it every night? And I was just like, no, if you want to eat some weird stuff, you can do that on your own ticket.
But yeah,
you know, in this flat, this is how it runs.
Can relate.
Really?
There was absolutely. Yeah. That's totally how I ate.
Yeah.
Yeah, up until like very recently.
Yeah.
But I have meat for every meal, not even just every dinner, but like, you know.
Oh, really?
Bacon for breakfast, and huge fan of, I love chicken so much.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not like a taste thing where you get some vegetarians being like, oh, I don't really like the taste of meat. Fuck that. It's delicious. That's why I can't wait for lab-based meat, cell meat.
Yeah.
Like, that's going to be a game changer.
It's a weird thing.
It's a great thing.
I think it's the way of the
science.
Future.
Yeah. It's science, doing a good job. But yeah, those things like doing a meat-free Friday.
I think it's a great thing.
Around that sort of thing. Yeah. I mean, if you want a really simple solution, that's definitely one. On the kind of like vegan experience as well, if people want a little window into that, because probably the main question I get asked when people find out I'm eating vegan is like, do you feel any different?
Oh, and yeah.
The answer is, nah, not really. Like the first 2 weeks of doing it, I was a little bit possibly more tired, but like, I don't know, I work at night, I go and do comedy gigs and stuff, so it's kind of hard to tease out what's me drinking.
And that can be toxins getting out of your body too.
Maybe,
and mind you, not if you were drinking.
You know, no point in giving up all the cool stuff.
No, absolutely.
And that's the other thing, people ask about beer a lot, about booze. So there used to be animal products used a lot more in beer production. And it's not really the case anymore. So even the big breweries don't use it. And like, there's pretty much no craft breweries that I've experienced that have animal products in their beers.
And of course, if you're vegan, you're into your craft beer.
Yeah, well, it goes with territory, doesn't it? Get the beard, get the craft beers. There's a great website called, Barvor, something like that. If you Google like vegan alcohol, it'll be the first thing that comes up. And it's got like every label of every booze, liquor, wine, and it'll tell you if it's vegan or not. A lot of wine uses animal products.
Mm. Yeah, I've heard that.
But I was talking to someone who makes wine recently, and they said the amount of animal products they use to make wine is like tiny. So if you're not being a militant vegan, it's totally all good.
I guess, are we promoting the militism?
We're not promoting anything. This has been my journey thus far. I don't even know if I'll like stay vegan forever.
Yeah,
who knows?
It's an experiment.
But it's going fine. For me, I am a lazy eater. Like, I love fast food. And luckily, there's more vegan fast food places popping up, like Lord of the Fries. Quick shout out. Their like chicken thing.
Great name.
Like KFC. It's so good. It's not super hard anymore. It used to be.
You know, it's just occurred to me that being vegan is similar to me doing that rubbish-free year.
Yeah.
It was just what I needed to do. And it's like it just made everything so simple. And it was like a real concerted push in the right direction. And it really, really helped like form new habits and think through all these things that I hadn't been thinking about. And
because sometimes if you just put a big parameter on yourself, you could just be really clear about something. So instead of me going like, you know, I'll try to eat more locally sourced food, and I'll try to eat more organic and stuff. It's like, I know that I won't be very good at that because I'm too lazy, basically.
Yeah.
I won't expend the energy.
It's funny, isn't it, that you can go to the extreme, and it's actually easier. It's because it's psychologically easier.
Totally. Yeah. It takes way less brain power. I just go like, okay, I can't eat that chicken. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, organic and free range or whatever, what certification free range it is. It's just like, oh no, I can't eat chicken. So it just reduces.
It's the same, does the same thing in your brain as routine in the morning.
Totally.
It's like you don't have to make decisions all the time through.
And I want to use my brain for different shit than like picking specific food brands I eat, you know?
I just had a meltdown with the toothpaste in the supermarket the other day. I was in a rush and I just quickly grab something, and then it's like I actually physically looked at the physicality of the space that the toothpaste takes up, and it's
daunting.
Oh no, it's daunting. Yeah, it's like probably 3 square meters, and it's just silly. Like, we just don't need that much. But it's without the routine. What we need is the brand that we go to, and we need that routine to and that's our way of getting rid of all of this, these choices and decisions we're constantly having to make.
Here's an idea for an app or a service. You get someone who you can hire, and you fill out a questionnaire up top of like, how much do you care about animals? How much do you care about the environment? What's your budget? And they go and shop for you.
Yeah.
And they like do all of the research on what brands
do what.
If
anyone's listening, get in touch.
Yeah, do that.
I need that.
Yeah, go and do the idea, and then get in touch because we
go
need
and
that
do
service.
The idea. Do all, yeah.
Go and make the business.
Go and make that app.
But wouldn't it be cool? You just fill in like a 20-question questionnaire one time at the start, and then have a weekly budget, and someone can charge like 5% of your shopping budget as for the service or something.
Yeah.
Free idea.
Yeah. No, gee, that was a gem. That was a gem. Tim, do you know what ruminant means?
No.
Oh, that's so great.
Tell me.
Well, because I just learned what ruminant meant. It's just so relevant to this conversation. And I thought, was that just me that doesn't know what ruminant means? So it's the name for all of these animals that we've been talking about, all the sort of pastoral ones. It's their little group. Just like you might have marsupials. Oh,
yeah.
No. It's like third word of the episode. It's a cruncher. But it's the ones that eat grass.
Huh.
I don't know if pigs are included.
Pigs might
but like
be a bit
goats,
different.
Cows, sheep.
Right.
What else is in that category?
I think you've named the biggest.
Llamas, etc.
It's weird that you knew that. Of course, llamas, as everyone knows.
So it's like ruminant animals is like the ones with multiple stomachs that allow them to be able to eat grass. And it's the ruminant animal farming that's particularly problematic.
Right. Do you know that that ability to break down grass is just like one enzyme that they have, which you can actually GM into people?
Oh, for goodness sakes, Tim.
Maybe that's the solution, though. Imagine if we could all just eat grass and turn that into energy, because we don't have the enzyme, so we can't break it down into energy. But
I think there's a few other issues there.
Like what?
Well, because so I did this cool workshop quite recently, actually, on edible weeds. We're in Tim's backyard, and I'm actually looking out the window, and I can actually see.
I mowed the lawn yesterday. I did a good job.
Oh, it's a lovely lawn.
Thank you.
It's
full of weeds.
So.
It's all at the same level, though.
I can see you've got little plants. There's one out there I can see called self-heal that I just learned about. You've got plantain. You've got daisy. All of those things are actually edible. So I'm telling you that now.
Okay.
Are you going to go out and start eating your lawn?
Probably not.
No, I think even if you did inject yourself with the new enzyme to be able to digest the grass, I think there's a few other issues that we have.
This is just the psychological barrier, though.
Well, it is.
Thing's about breaking that down.
Yeah. It's commodification of stuff.
Yeah.
That we get so many marketing messages that it's better to buy something than eat your lawn.
Very, very true. That's very true. And actually, there's a... So this is a bridge I haven't had to cross yet, but I think I already know how I treat it. But insects is really interesting.
Oh, I really want to do a show on insects.
We should get an expert in on eating insects, because I'm really fascinated by that.
Oh, on eating them?
Yeah, on eating them, because apparently insects are incredibly efficient protein machines.
Yes, I've heard that before too.
So they have been floated as a potential real godsend for the current problem we have around the amount of energy and damage we do through our current agricultural farming, is that if we started farming insects and eating them, we could get a ton of protein off them for, like, you know, not a lot of outlay, and they just multiply like crazy. They're really easy to farm. And that's a living thing, right? It's an insect. But I don't put that in my brain at all on the same level as I would like a pig or a cow or anything. So I have no issue with eating insects, because I don't think they have...
I think it's the opposite for a lot of people.
I know, but that, yeah.
Because, don't give me a steak, don't give me that bug on a stick.
They've got an issue,
like,
for
Asia,
a
right? You've been to Thailand,
been to Thailand
and China, yep, where it's like bugs on sticks.
Yeah, I've eaten stuff in Thailand. I think I had a scorpion and maybe a spider and stuff like that. Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's just more meat. It's just a different kind of meat when it's the big ones. But that will be a podcast for another day. But that's another potential solution. And it's like, I don't know.
Who do you think's won the debate?
Well, I don't know if there was a debate.
I don't think we had one.
I don't think we had one either.
I'm a bit disappointed.
Well,
I think we're actually on the same page with so much, and we've come down to you and I having different approaches right now to how we're working through. And one thing I wanted to say that I didn't, and it's something that makes me feel really uncomfortable, is the... we've been assuming this the association with, you know, it's kind of this, you know, this ethical choice to be eating organic or avoiding meat and all that sort of stuff. And in the back of my mind, I've got my family and other people I know that are actually farmers that aren't farming organically. They're just, you know, good old Kiwi regular farmers. Yeah. And I hate the thought that they could be listening, or anyone who's a farmer could be listening to this thing, and they're sitting there uncomfortably, and these are really good people. You know, they're actually, you know, caring for their land and doing...
We should get a farmer in, because we might be talking out of goddamn holes in our heads.
Yeah, I know. You know? Let's bring the farmer to Central City.
Because I know, and also, that's a really good point, actually, Waveney. If you are a farmer, or you know a farmer, or you're related to a farmer, Kiwi farmers are like a hell of a lot better than what they're doing in the States and stuff. So I don't know. There's probably a lot of assumptions I have that are potentially wrong.
And I think there's also this, just with the farming community, as in anywhere, like our listeners generally, there's this huge desire, I think. There's an acknowledgement now that things could be done better, and there's this huge desire to try and work out how to do things better. Yeah,
totally. But I think, on the other hand, like, I don't want to cede too much ground, because I think there has been a total normalization of just fucking over animals completely emotionally for ages so that we can have cheap milk, you know. Like, we're taking away a cow's babies from it, which stresses it out to no end, so that we can have tons of cheap milk.
Oh, I can see the conversation now.
I totally want to give credit where it's due to, particularly our farmers in New Zealand, who are investing so much R&D into trying to come up with the most sustainable practices and look after animals to an extent. But at the base level, this is still a set of farming practices that are just, like, not great for animals. I think. Happy to be proven wrong. That'll probably do it for us.
Yeah, I reckon.
The takeaway thing to reiterate, because we'd like to put that at the end of the episode, is if you want to help save the world, hey, if you're in a position to and you really want to, go vegetarian. Give it a go. Give it a go for like 2 weeks. See how you feel. If not, do like a meat-free day once a week. And maybe do like a little challenge for yourself like I did. Set a timer on it. And then just assess where you're at. So maybe do like a month of meat-free Fridays. You say, I'm going to do that. And
do
then
you
just
have
see
to be
go.
Catholic to do that as well?
No, it helps.
Good to know.
Yeah. Anything you want to add, Waveney?
Well, option B would be to, from my perspective, would be to also try eating less meat and buying organic, buying at your local farmer's market.
There you go. A whole raft of tips for you good people on how to save the world. We will catch you in the next episode. Thank you very much for listening.
See ya.
If we have any chance of saving the world, we all need businesses to make changes. And fast. Contact Go Well Consulting to make sure your business is part of the better future. Go to gowellconsulting.co.nz to find an expert that will help your business navigate the journey.